Welcome to our Saturday podcast. Really feel honored to have our next guest, a profoundly important man, certainly not only globally, but in the city of Los Angeles. Dr. Patrick Chong is a surgeon, a businessman, a billionaire, a Lakers minority owner since 2010, owner of the LA Times and San Diego Tribune. It should be noted the LA Times coverage has been remarkable since he purchased the paper. He's the owner of NantWorks, a network of health startups, and the inventor of the cancer drug Abraxane. I hope they got that right, which helps fight lung, breast, and pancreatic cancer. Sold multiple drug companies. Born in South Africa, moved to L.A., and has been an enormously important part of our community. Doctor, I want to start with this. You bought St. Vincent's Hospital in Los Angeles specifically for COVID patients, and you're partnering with Microsoft for COVID research. You're also CEO of two companies creating COVID treatments and vaccines. And I want to start with vaccines. I read a bit this morning that the average time between 1998 and 2009 to develop a vaccine on average was just under 11 years. Are the stories and reports that we could have a vaccine in a year or slightly less or slightly more, are those just simply unrealistic going forward?
No, I don't think so. And so let me just explain to you the difference. And it's not just semantics, but many, many years ago, when we were trying to develop vaccines, the method of actually producing them required things like eggs or creating the taking the virus and what we call attenuating or killing the virus, etc. What's happened since then is the advent of genomics. So because we have now the sequence of the virus, there's possibilities of having truly next generation type of vaccines, where the virus, because of its known sequence, could be engineered into different delivery systems and administered to generate immunity. So that kind of technology didn't exist before. Having said that, it's still not a trivial exercise to actually identify the right sequence, number one, and identify the right vehicle to deliver that sequence.
I was reading another story, it may have been from New Scientist, where there's only a 33% success rate of vaccines that even make it into trials. Are you confident today that there will be a vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, I'm hopeful in the sense that on the basis of the science that I'm watching and the science that we're performing inside our own organization, is that out of all the community of scientists, there will be a vaccine. What I'm concerned about is that this is a vicious virus, what I call almost a genius virus, that has all kinds of ways of evading the immune system. So it's built within itself not only the infectivity of getting infected, but it's also built within itself ingenious ways, which we're discovering as we're developing the vaccine, of evading the immune system. So we really won't know even until we injected the first patients. And even the animal studies won't really help us because the animal models don't behave like the human models. So it's much more complex than making blanket statements. Having said that, based on what we do know and the rapid science of us identifying how this virus works in a remarkable short piece of time gives me great confidence that we will find a vaccine.
One of the first things that appeared to be true was that for some reason it was much more punitive, doctor, to older Americans, much less punitive to younger Americans. Now, we know influenza can be very tough on children. What was your initial thought on how it was staggeringly tough on older Americans, not so much so with kids? Did that mean anything to you?
Oh, it meant a lot. And because we're watching how this virus works, remarkably, one of the ways it actually replicates or grows inside your human body is that it finds a way to kill the cells that normally protect you, called the natural killer cells. So NK cells and T cells actually deplete as you age. So it wasn't surprising that in the aged population and in the predisposed population, such as diabetic patients, who have a deficient NK cell level as you age, that this virus would attack. So not only does it attack because you have a low NK and T cells, it actually finds a way to kill NK and T cells as it attacks. So that was one of the therapies that we needed to address, is to activate the patient's natural killer cells. And in this is no different from cancer. So this is what I said when I looked at this virus. This virus is behaving like cancer. Cancer finds a way to attack your body. Cancer finds a way to evade the immune system. And cancer finds a way to suppress your natural killer cells. The virus does exactly the same, and we can fight it with a molecule that actually activates the NK cells.
One of the things I've noticed, I live in a beach community in Los Angeles, where we've had very low infection rate, really low death rate. We've had no hospital surge as of yet. And I've noticed this in other beach communities. I've noticed this in Florida, where despite looser restrictions, there hasn't been the hospital surge as of yet. Could there be something about the wind next to the water, the vitamin D, the sunlight? This is just something casually I watch. I'm surprised the numbers in Florida are lower. How do we explain Florida? Why does it seem to be more punitive to northern cities in America? Does that mean anything?
Well, I think, first of all, let's talk about California and Los Angeles. Now, I worked with Governor Newsom very early on in February. And I think he made exactly the right decision of shutting down and quarantining, social distancing, not just the community, but businesses early on. Then I worked with him to ensure that we would have healthcare capacity, and that was the basis of the St. Vincent's Medical Center or the Los Angeles Surge Hospital. I think making the right decisions early on has saved so many lives because, as you could see, one, we had a very flattened curve. Two, we did not overtake the healthcare capacity. And three, the Surge Hospital was there in case that happened. With regard to the beach community, I think it's another reflection of distancing, right? I mean, I know Malibu and I know the areas around, and there are very few people close to each other on the beach. And then sunlight definitely has an effect. This is a what we call an RNA virus with a capsule, and it's not very stable in heat. And so, therefore, sunlight does have effect.
Okay. How do we reconcile the balance between economy and health? I mean, just mental health. 47,000 Americans on average commit suicide annually, with people being shut in, sheltered in, with the social media, a lot of negativity, pessimistic views. I see a mental health crisis growing. How do we reconcile starting the economy, maintaining social distancing during a pandemic? I mean, there's no easy answers, right?
Well, let's just dissect them all, right? I think mental health is clearly an issue that needs to be addressed, but part of that mental health is fear, and fear of the unknown, fear of the unpredictability. And that's why, you know, at the LA Times, we tried to establish an explanation video called The Science Behind Coronavirus, and trying to reassure the community that there will be a solution. So I think the first step is to really have some level of reassurance and hope, but not false hope. So the hope that on the one hand we could address treatment, that I think the mental health is the unpredictability of who's infected, but more importantly, will I die because of this vicious nature of this? And now because we're beginning to understand how patients go into ICU and have 60-70% mortality, that we can mitigate that. That mitigation in a very short period of time, we've learned, is very real. At the end of the day, for us to get to real normality, is we need a vaccine. And I think this Operation Warp Speed that has now been instigated by HHS and BARDA is exactly the process by which we can get back to work as fast as we can. Getting back to work is really important, but living is probably more important than getting back to work, which means then we need to find ways of testing and controlled access to work, which then turns around, we need to establish testing methods that we can do on a daily basis, because you have no idea, you could be tested negative today and be positive tomorrow. And that testing is what we're developing also in Los Angeles, where we can actually establish testing methods equivalent to that to Korea.
Yeah.
So I think it's not a straightforward one-off answer. One, we absolutely need to figure out a way to get the economy back. Two, this is where the government now stepping in, and they are stepping in with trillions of dollars is being made available to both small businesses, large businesses, and the community. And then three, to provide hope and information. And I hope somebody can look at the science behind coronavirus in the LA Times. That's what we've done. And that video is on YouTube, and you can get it's a long series, almost a Netflix-like series. But it tries to provide insight and hope and some level of control. I feel you can control what you can control, you have less fear, and then you have less mental anxiety. And then I honestly believe December and maybe even earlier, we'll have a real idea of what vaccine is available. And hopefully a vaccine is available that we can enter into what we call emergency use approval.
Dr. Patrick Shong is joining us. When I read about what other countries do, China, South Korea, every country has their laws, rules, and regulations. And when I look at America, there are certain personal freedoms here that Americans expect. And as a global citizen, doctor, do you look at America in comparison to other countries? Is it an advantage or disadvantage going forward on how to govern our country? Do we have too many freedoms for the average citizen, and they're going to push back on government? How does that, in your worldview, is America uniquely qualified or uniquely challenged to battle this going forward?
Well, look at my personal position. I was born in South Africa. I'm Chinese, came to America. I am an American citizen. And I look upon myself as exactly living the American dream. This country is one, the most innovative, most compassionate, most generous country, I think, in the world. And there's no other place I'd want to be. And so we are not only uniquely qualified with the resources and the brain power and the freedom, I think we probably not only are uniquely qualified, we're actually uniquely qualified to lead the world in this pandemic.
Are you concerned when you hear a vaccine could be fast-tracked? Does that concern you at all?
Not at all. It has to be fast-tracked. In fact, as I said, the only way out of this is a vaccine, period. And because of the technology we have the largest machine learning supercomputing platforms. We have the most amazing scientists. We have the NAID that's involved in this, BARDA is involved with this, the resources. If any country could fast-track a vaccine, it'll be this country.
Do you worry about the partisanship getting in the way of that?
Very much. Well, I do in a sense, but I think we'll get over that, right? I think we as a nation are so strong. Got our innovation, our compassion, our leadership. The history of this, we'll get through it. It may have exposed certain things in that are deficient, which I've been fighting for 15 years, is really the what I call the integration of the healthcare system. I've been fighting for 15 to 20 years to create what I call the NORAD of healthcare, so that we can monitor in real time. That's one of the keys that both Taiwan and Korea had, the capability to monitor your health. If we can do that, then contact tracing becomes an issue and not an issue. And if you do contact tracing and isolation, you don't need to shut down the entire economy. Unfortunately, what this has unearthed is the absence of that infrastructure. And this is what I call the next generation infrastructure of telemedicine, telehealth, the internet, the fiber infrastructure, the supercomputing, all of which we have, but we've not dedicated it to the world of healthcare. And that's, if you look at my history, what I've been fighting for literally 20 years of my life now. But we also have the greatest innovators in terms of science. So taking science, genomics, and what we have, I think we could lead the nation and then overcome the difficult issues that we're facing as we face today.
Doctor, you bought the St. Vincent's Hospital in Los Angeles specifically for this. I've got a handful of friends, ER doctors, a couple of surgeons I know, general practitioners. They have said to me that the hospitals they currently work at are empty. There are COVID patients, but there's no surgeries being performed. The trauma units are empty because, you know, people aren't driving. Bars aren't open. This is an interesting situation, which you have firsthand experience. Are you concerned at all that there are going to be a series or a network of hospitals that are going to go under financially as we battle this because people simply don't want to go to the hospital if they believe there are many COVID patients there?
And completely right. And that was one of my greatest concerns, right? And that's why when I said to the governor, let's create a hospital that's 100% COVID, which is St. Vincent's Medical Center and maybe even Seton or St. Francis. So if we create two or three hospitals that are just 100% COVID, and all these other hospitals could send their patients there in real time, many things will benefit from that. Number one, you'll create centers of excellence. You'll have clinicians who are then every day in, day out, understand the nuance of how to manage a COVID patient from a mild to moderate to a patient that's near death. We'll free up then the other hospitals so that they're not concerned about exposure. And we've done that, actually. These hospitals, even our surge hospital, is not full.
Dr. Patrick Shong is joining us, the surgeon, businessman, Lakers minority owner since 2010, owner of the LA Times and San Diego Tribune. I've lived through H1N1 and SARS. This does appear, however, to at least be, if not more deadly, certainly more contagious. Do we know at this point, because so many people have it asymptomatically, do we know if it appears to be more contagious? Is it more deadly?
It's completely more contagious and more deadly. And let me explain why. When SARS-CoV-2, which is this mutated, a few amino acids from SARS-CoV, it became 20 times more infective than SARS. More importantly, this has now taken on this thing called the ACE2 receptor as its mode of entry into your body.
Okay.
Unfortunately, ACE2 receptor is in many cells of your body, in your lungs, and scarily enough, it's actually on your blood vessels. It's in your kidney, your liver, your gut. So when we see diseases like Kawasaki disease, when you see cardiac disease, when you see respiratory failure, now you're seeing pathogenesis that you've never seen before. When you add on top of that it's infective in patients that are asymptomatic days before they have symptoms, and it's infectious 30 days after you have the virus infection, you begin to understand why this is so different and so scary, which means two things is so critical. We need to find testing so to test and ensure that the patient is negative, even asymptomatic. And secondly, we need to have a vaccine quickly so we can stop this thing.
Shifting from COVID-19, of the many businesses you certainly could have purchased, when you sold Abraxas and American Pharmaceutical Partners for a combined $9.1 billion, you chose as one of the businesses to purchase the LA Times, the San Diego Tribune, the newspaper business, which, with few exceptions in this country, had been struggling. Why did you choose to buy the LA Times? What about that did you see as a good business opportunity?
I didn't look upon it as a business opportunity. In fact, some of my business friends said they thought I was smart until I did that. And the reason I did that, this is me coming to this country, being so grateful for the freedoms and the ability to actually, not only, I don't see this as a philanthropic thing to give back, but I saw it as so important to have a paper for the community and a paper that actually is filled with integrity and providing real information. And I think COVID speaks to that. Despite the fact that we've lost 50% of our revenue from advertising, believe it or not, struggling financially, our editors and editorial staff and newsroom has stepped up. And as you said at the beginning, they've provided amazing information, and it's so necessary. So I think COVID speaks to exactly why we exist and why it should exist, papers like us, throughout this nation.
When you look at going forward as a global citizen, the newspaper and the journalism business, are you concerned they're being limited? It's not as well capitalized, and that the best days of journalism are behind us?
I'm very concerned, and we need to find a way where, one, the public, i.e. subscribers, figured this out with us as newspaper owners. New York Times is surviving now through six million subscribers.
Yeah,
we have one tenth of that, if not. We relied hugely on advertising revenue, except that's now not only gone to almost to zero, sadly, because of the social media, that's been taken away. So I am very concerned, but I think that's why we took on this challenge, in fact. And I'm hopeful that we can work with the Congress to find ways to support these institutions.
How often do you talk to the governor of California or the mayor of Los Angeles in regards to the current pandemic? Are you in daily or weekly briefings and discussions?
Yes. I mean, I'm on text terms with the governor, and I'm on his task force. I've accepted to be on his task force. I've taken on, within the task force, the subdivision of the task force that talks about what do we need to do to open up businesses urgently. We've been in constant contact with regard to the Los Angeles Surge Hospitals, both in Northern and Southern California. So, no, and then with Mark Galli, the HHS Secretary of California. So, no, I think I'm grateful for the fact that we, are in close communication, and that he's very proactive and really takes advice to heart.
Let's talk about one industry in particular, aviation flying. LAX is not very far. In fact, you can see it from your LA Times building. With what you know with COVID and its contagious nature, should we shut down air travel for a short period of time? Is it safe to fly, in your opinion?
Well, let me just take it personally. I would not fly. Right. And it is no question that the air systems in the that this one sneeze could travel through, 6 to 8 feet in the plane. And I think the epitome of this is the virologist at NBC, who is a virus hunter, as you may know, just came down with COVID a couple of days ago as a consequence of traveling in a plane to New Orleans. So I think, and he had a mask on and gloves on. I'm unfortunately, confined space like that for a prolonged period of time is pretty high risk.
Doctor, thank you for stopping by. I don't know much about this. I stay socially distanced from everybody but my family. I wear a mask generally in public, certainly in stores. I appreciate you stopping by and answering questions and giving some information to our audience, sir.
You're welcome. Stay safe.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce somebody whose work I've admired for a long time. I first heard of Mike Tolan years ago as he was the executive producer of Arliss, which was really, I thought, pre-Entourage, sort of a really smart, clever, inside look at the world of sports from an executive/agent side. Mike is now the co-chairman of Mandalay Sports Media, along with Chairman Peter Guber, who is on our show occasionally. Of course, Peter's partial owner of the Warriors, Dodgers, and LAFC. That's a nice troika. Mike's the executive producer of The Last Dance. We will see episodes, the final episodes, 9 and 10 this Sunday. Also producer of Varsity Blues, Coach Carter, Radio. And one of my all-time favorite documentaries, Small Potatoes, What Killed the USFL, which if you have never seen it, it's just a riot. And it's fascinating if you love football. And Mike is now joining us. Plus, he's a Pac-12 Stanford guy. And he was a former play-by-play guy in college. I looked that up last night. So instead of doing what guys like me do, which is, get behind a mic, you made real money. You've had a heck of a career. Let's start with this, Mike, The Last Dance. When you went into it, what was sort of your mission, or do you even need one when you go into a documentary?
Well, you need one. You need the mission is to make something happen, In baseball, they say you can fail 7 out of 10 times and still make the Hall of Fame, right? In my world, you can fail 997 out of 1,000 times and still make the Hall of Fame. It's a low shooting percentage to get things made. Everybody looks at the media landscape and they say, oh, there's so many platforms. It's just like anybody can get a show on. It's so competitive. The barriers to entry are so low, and everybody's out there. It's got a show under their arm. So the point is, it's really competitive, it's really tough, and you have to be strategic. You also have to just put a lot of things on the board and hope the chips fall in your direction every now and then, right? So with this one, the stakes were huge. This is big game hunting. Everybody knew since the late 90s that the NBA had shot the final season of the Bulls dynasty, right? It's legend by now. Andy Thompson is Michael Thompson's brother, and Clay Thompson's uncle was a field producer at NBA Entertainment. And he went to Adam Silver, the now commissioner, of course, who back then was the president of NBA Entertainment. And they decided, this is historic. Everybody knew Phil Jackson, Jerry Krause were at odds. The team was going to break up. Jerry famously told Phil, you could go 82-0, and you're still going to be coaching your last season with the Bulls. So they figure, we got to get this. And the agreement was made with Reinsdorf, with Krause, with Jackson, with Jordan. We won't do anything with this unless we come to a mutual understanding. So let us shoot it. We'll put it on the shelves. Michael, worst case scenario, you'll have the best home movie collection ever, right? So they said, yeah, and off they went. As you saw in episode 1, they were there from the very beginning, shooting the Bulls going to Paris like rock stars, right? They were the most, Michael's the most famous guy on the planet, as Oprah says. They're a worldwide phenomena. So they're there till the very end, till the final shot, which, of course, we'll see Sunday night after the push-off. Was it a push-off, Colin? Was it a push-off? Brian Russell? Nah. Let it go. By the way, I got to tell you this because 9 and 10 are coming up, right, tomorrow night.
Right.
You will see one of the most underrated, incredible push-offs in NBA playoff history, administered by Reggie Miller. This one's forgotten. But before the Bulls could get to the Utah Jazz.
Oh, I remember this. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I mean Reggie knew it. He said it in the huddle. The refs are going to swallow their whistle. He just flat out, knocks Michael over. Incredible. Then goes on to make the winning shot. Anyway, everybody knew this treasure trove of material existed. Frank Marshall, Danny DeVito, Spike Lee, everybody wanted to do it. For whatever reason, and I had my suspicions, Michael kept saying, nah, not interested, don't want to be bothered, came back, played for the Wizards, bought the Hornets, just, I got my life, leave me alone, basically. Fast forward to 2016 was when I jumped into the fray. Couple things happen, I think. You know, the goal is for every producer to turn a no into a yes, right? So how do you do that? People have speculated the day I flew on a red eye to Charlotte was the day that LeBron James and the Cavaliers were parading through Cleveland with their trophy, having just come back from a 3-1 deficit to beat the Warriors. Ironically, the team that broke the Bulls' regular season record was 73 wins. I'm talking 96. So, 2016, so 18 years later. I went in, and now people want to connect the dots and say, oh, that's why Michael said yeah, right? Because LeBron just
right.
Won. Nah. I mean, Colin, have you ever heard Michael Jordan say a word about his goatness? Have you ever heard him advocate for himself? No. He he's his airness, right? I always think of Michael as above the fray. LeBron, yes, he's been out there saying, I'm the GOAT.
Yeah.
Michael's got other things to worry about, right? This guy's got, his $2 billion franchise, his multi-zillion dollar businesses. He's building a golf course. He's got five kids. He's got a new grandchild. He's got a beautiful wife. I just feel like there's a zenness to Michael. I'll give Phil Jackson a lot of credit for that, because the coaching that went on there with Phil was not just on the court. As you know, there was a whole spiritual path that.
And
both,
so,
right?
But Mike, why did he do it then?
So here's the thing. I think Michael was concerned about the interpretation of his behavior. We've heard about it now,
yeah.
Right? We've heard him called all kinds of names. Steve Kerr talks about, getting a black eye. His intensity, the way he bullied Scotty Burrell, the demands he made on his players. I think he thought it would be interpreted as, this is a jerk. This is a bully. This is a bad guy. My pitch was the documentary landscape had changed. Instead of just a one-off doc where you only get the surface, we can now do an event. We can do 10 episodes as we've done. We can show the full arc of the character of the relationships, and we can see the method behind the madness. We can see the motivation. It's not to be a bad guy. It's not to pick on these guys. It's to raise their level. It's to elevate their play. It's to get them into the winning mindset. That's why people went nuts at the end of episode 7 last week. He finally said it, right? And when you see him getting emotional and actually saying, break, stop the camera, because he knew he was losing it, he was talking about who he is as a guy. I never demanded anything from my players that I didn't demand of myself. And so I think people got a new insight. And I think, look, Michael can do whatever he wants. I think he has been out of the game long enough and is in a quiet enough place in his life that he was ready to be open, to be candid, to be reflective, and that's what people are really responding to.
Does it bother you at all? It doesn't me, because I feel this is a storytelling venture. I'm not learning. It's an amplification of what I knew because I lived through it and covered it. And there's some video that's amazing, but I feel like it's just amplifying what I loved. It's the best basketball team I've ever seen. It's the best American sports team I've ever seen. Maybe the Steelers in the 70s were close, but some have said, well, Michael's got the final edits here, Mike, and it's not real journalism. Does that bother you?
Well, all I can say, Colin, and Jason Hare, our extremely talented director, has said this several times publicly. Michael didn't edit anything. I mean, no kidding. Honest to goodness. Not one, please take this out or please soften that line. I mean, look what's in there. I mean, he accepts all these people saying what they say about him. He's been really open about his feelings about Isaiah. We've talked about all the grudges and how they inspired him. The only thing, he watched them all. He had an opportunity to discuss with us. He didn't have final cut. He basically trusted us. I mean, I think he saw guys that had done their homework, that had the credibility, that were trying to make an honest portrait. The only thing he did on occasion was actually suggest an addition. For instance, when he came back from playing baseball, he's a little rusty. We show that game against Indiana where he was way off. And then we jumped to the double nickel game when he scored 55 against the Knicks in the Garden. He looked at it and he said, I think you guys might want to go back and see this footage of the game. The fifth game back against Atlanta, I hit a buzzer beater to win the game, and it really gave me the confidence without which I'm not sure I'd have been at that level for the next game. Good call. We missed it. We put it in, and it helped. But he really just there was enormous trust. You know, we sat with him three extensive interviews. We did 8 or 9 hours of dialogue. We talked in between. He saw where we were going. No, there's no, you know, there was a Ken Burns thing about Ken came out and said, I would never do a film where the participants are part of the production team. You know, that's not good history. That's not good journalism. Well, first of all, Ken hadn't seen a frame of the show yet, and still hasn't. He actually made a phone call and apologized for the way the story broke. And we weren't going to do it if we felt like it was going to be censored. You know, the NBA is a partner. Esty Portnoy and Curtis Polk, Michael's partners, are a part of the team. But you got to believe me, Colin, we weren't going to do this as a puff piece. And while you say you haven't learned that much because you go into this thing knowing too much, I mean, you know, this is your world. You're an expert. But Colin, the people that come up to me and thank me because their families are getting together on Sunday night, old school, right? Old school family viewing, Monday morning water cooler culture, talking about this. Bill Bradley. Okay, Bill Bradley knows a little about basketball. He called me on a Monday morning after the first couple episodes and said, I had no idea about that Scottie Pippen thing. $18 million for 7 years, 122nd highest paid player in the league. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are getting tremendous insight, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, listen. Hey, I've loved it. I have supported from the beginning. I think it's fantastic. I think I don't do a lot of walk down memory lane radio. That's not really my shtick.
Right.
I don't. I have been obsessed with this, and so I hope you don't see that as a criticism. I feel like I'm getting, like, I think documentaries are fascinating and important, and one of the reasons is because they tighten up and button up my memory, because over time, Mike, our memories fool us.
Right.
We think we were happier than we were. We're more critical. Like, for instance, Mike was better at baseball than I gave him credit for, and I said mm-hmm. this, you know what? I didn't know about the 13-game hitting streak, and frankly, I knew about the instructional league, and frankly, when I heard all the interviews, I thought, you know what? I was a little harsh. I was too reactionary. Maybe I was a follower in that, didn't do enough homework. So when I think documentaries button up and they strengthen our loving memories of people, and so the information is stuff that we you know, let's be honest about it. Our childhoods, a therapist will tell you this. We always make them better or worse than they were.
Right.
If you could do a documentary on Mike Tolan's childhood, you'd be like, oh, really? My dad wasn't that bad or my mom wasn't that mean. So I think it's been incredibly crucial. Now, I will say this. You interviewed Michael several times. One of the things I loved, Mike, was when you give him the iPad.
Right.
And I thought it was a brilliant touch. Whose idea was it? And I think I've gotten, honestly, the best reactions of this entire doc have been those iPad moments. Whose idea?
Jason Hare, the director, gets the credit. We talked about it. I said, man, you've just like reinvented the genre. He goes, nah, it's been done before. And we've actually talked about it. It has been done before. It's just never been done on a platform like this. I mean, let's face it. This documentary has been viewed. Well, it's broken all kinds of records.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of crazy in that sense. So people are probably seeing it for the first time. It was his cool call, and it really worked because it created a dialogue, you know, with he was so attentive. That's the thing, Colin. He came leaning in. Look, Michael's legendary. If he's in, he's all the way in. When Jason first read him that quote about the early days when the Bulls were terrible, he comes in 84, and they're just, you know, they've been in the league since 66. They've never even smelled a title. And he tells him about this article he's read where the Bulls were called the Flying Cocaine Circus. And
yes.
Michael cracks up and you realize he's never heard it before. Yeah. And then instead of just like, next question, he goes on and describes the debauchery in great detail, right? So you see he's really in. When Jason gives him the iPad and Gary Payton is trash talking about the 96 finals and Michael just hands it back to him and says, the glove. I had no problem with the glove. It's brilliant. And then the Dennis Rodman taking a vacation and Isaiah Thomas talking about the move of not shaking hands after the Bulls finally beat him. Yeah, it was really, it really felt like it sparked the dialogue. The thing is, and I got to give Phil Jackson again, I mean, one of the things I learned was the dimension of Phil's genius.
Yes.
Incredible. His influence. Michael And Mark Vansel, who's Michael's biographer, talks about this in episode 10. So present, so focused. You know, we all talk now about mindfulness. I mean, this guy was, you know, he was a generation ahead. And again, whether that was Phil or that's just innately part of Michael, his ability to concentrate, to focus, to understand the situation and what it demands. You'll see him relaxing a few hours before the finals with Utah. He's listening to music on his headphones, and he's comfortable. You know, people only think of the intense, competitive Michael. You see him leading a competition where the Bulls are all shooting from the hash mark. It kind of looks like a Steph Curry, Steve Kerr 2018 practice. You know, it's light, it's loose. So there's so many dimensions to the guy.
You know what, Mike, one of the things, and this is not a criticism of LeBron, but LeBron is building a media empire. He's got an opinion on many political moments. Michael comes off to me, and I heard his daughter Jasmine Jordan talked about this recently. He's a private guy in a public sector.
Right.
That he is largely, Mike, hidden from us since his retirement.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons people are so fascinated, because they don't feel like they ever got a window into the real Michael, and this is the most revealing he's been. I mean, the guys who covered him, you know, Wilbon, Sam Smith, all these guys are like, wow, you know, I never heard Michael say that. He was so good. You know, him and Jeter, right? They're handsome, they're charming, they're magnetic, they smile, they give you something. You go away, you look at your pads or you listen to the tape, it's like, huh? What did he say? Invariably nothing, really. But he's now... Look, he's 57 years old. He's been away from the game, certainly as a player. Obviously, he's still there as an owner. He's got perspective. He's got wisdom. He's got gravitas. And he's MJ, man. There's none other.
Yeah. You know, I think the co-stars of this, for me, have been his parents.
Mm.
And one of the things that struck me, Mike Tolan joining us, was that how refined and polished he was. And you have to be careful when you discuss this, because it's never the fault of the child. But if you look at the great leaders in sports, Phil Jackson, MJ, Peyton Manning, Brady, Jeter, they often have great parental support.
Right. You know, Phil's parents were missionaries.
Yes.
And Phil describes himself as a seeker, okay, interested in Native American culture, traveling everywhere, into the Bible, all kinds of different religions. I mean, this guy, his path to the NBA, it went through Puerto Rico, it went through the CBA, open to everything, and you know, brought incense to the Bulls locker room, right? Michael's parents, I mean, so grounded.
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, and Mike, what's fascinating about MJ, not to interrupt, he had a blue-collar work ethos.
Right.
But the glamour and coolness that attracted the coasts. And I think that's really valuable. A regular guy loved how hard he worked and how much winning mattered. But, you know, the coast, New York, L.A., we like cool. We're a little more glamorous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Michael really cuts through that. It's very, you know, Brett Favre, you loved him on the coast. John Madden loved him, but he was the Midwest and he was from the South. When you get these iconic figures, they often cut through. Jeff Gordon, by the way. You know, I mean, when I look at Michael, I look at his parents, and all their messaging was so solid and smart and grounded in work ethic and values. And that's why I believe Michael was so capable as a rookie in the NBA of grabbing the baton for the league and saying, I'm going to run it. I don't think most kids at that age can. I think his parents deserve so much credit in this. Were you blown away by it? Were you surprised at how valuable they have been to his journey?
Yeah, we always, of course, heard about his dad, because his dad was his companion. He was there. He was his inspiration, his rock. You know, when his dad died, Michael went back to play baseball. Everybody just associated that with, you know, he was a little leaguer. That was the sport his dad taught him. That's what he focused on.
Yeah.
But then you start seeing his mom, and you see that, again, one of those iPad moments where his mom reads the letter from Michael at school, sends stamps.
Yes.
That's so great. And you see this skinny, sweet kid riding his bicycle through Chapel Hill. I also love the backyard battles with his older brother, Larry, right? Like, it couldn't be Larry. It was war, as he said. I have an older brother, Larry, too, by the way, and I also got cut from my high school varsity team after sophomore year. That's about it for the parallels, however. No, I mean, his father used to talk about how, like, you know, he couldn't tell a Phillips head from a flathead screwdriver or whatever. Michael was really clear about it. He talks about being suspended 3 times, which, by the way, didn't get much attention. I mean, he was getting in trouble. He was, you know, he was just kind of testing the boundaries.
Sure.
And then when his father said, look, this is it, you know, and he realized, if I don't straighten up, I'm not going to play sports. And then he started to focus, and then he grew, and then he became who he is. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's born in the backyard, man, that competitiveness, that win at all costs, that, you know, keep your nose clean, and there are rewards out there for you. I think you're right, too, Colin, about the mix of urban and rural. In our business, there's this damning response where you pitch a show, and they go, ah, coastal elite, right?
Right.
You know, it's L.A., it's New York, it's not going to work in the heartland. Michael works everywhere.
Yes. Mike Tolan is joining us. He's the co-chairman, Mandalay Sports Media, the executive producer of The Last Dance, and a notable filmography, which is too vast, or I'd take up half my podcast, a remarkable career. Now, again, I Peter Vesey tends to be fairly irascible, good information.
Right.
Some have said, why wasn't Peter in it? Now, there's a lot of interviews. I've never felt like it's missing people because I think the video itself, the sound, the audio from Michael, you know, Jerry Krause, Michael, Phil Jackson. I don't feel like it's missing anybody, but there are those who have said, why not Peter Vesey? So I might as well ask that question.
Man, Colin, the list of why not, I could list 20 for you right now. Okay, so we did 106. Including Mike, well, 105 plus 3 times Michael Jordan, so 108 interviews. I've never been involved in a project where people literally called us to say, hey, are you going to interview me? I don't want to mention names because these are great guys who would have added something. I mean, it's just a question of, you know, making choices, logistics, travel, time, you know, Spike Lee's not in there. Just couldn't quite figure out the timing. Would have loved to have had Karl Malone along with John Stockton helping tell the story of the two straight finals against Utah in 97 and 98. See, I said I wasn't going to mention names, and now I mentioned a few. I'm going to stop there. Just say friends of mine from the media are insulted and may never talk to me again because they feel slighted that they weren't included. Peter's great, you know. So is Marv Albert. There's another one. Oh, I'm going to stop.
Right.
Colin Cowherd, why don't we interview you?
Yeah.
You would have had a perspective. No, it's just a question of, you know, maxing out and having to make choices. We apologize to everybody who could have been, should have been, would have added something to us, to the film, but we just didn't quite get there.
Well, I mean, social media now, nobody likes anybody, Mike. You know, nobody likes any project. Even the stuff you like, you bail on. It's the reality. I said this once. I had the great honor of interviewing President Obama twice.
Right.
And just as an aside, you know, they give you 8 minutes. And I asked him a question at the end of the second interview, and he just extrapolated, went on and on. And the question was about social media. I said, no commissioner's popular. They don't even like Trudeau in Canada. Canada likes everybody. Is that we live in a time now where any project is just going to get picked apart in social media. I look at the MJ doc, The Last Dance, and I love it. It makes me happy. I feel like I'm getting this polish, this refined look at this story I loved that we'll never see again. So there's always going to be critics in social media. There's no barrier to entry. It's free to join. Anybody can have an opinion. But I would ask you, any regrets, or like me, do you look at it and think, you know what, this is really a nice piece that 10 years from today I'll be proud of?
Well, thanks for all that, Colin. First of all, that means a lot coming from you. I value your perspective. I actually don't have to wait 10 years. I feel proud of it right now. I think we all do. We had a Zoom the night before the first episode. No red carpet premieres, right? We had all these plans, right? We had 5 cities. We were going to do L.A., New York, Chicago, D.C., the Smithsonian, you know, star-studded red carpets, the whole deal. Instead, we were in our homes with a cocktail and 16 or so people on the screen congratulating one another. And on pops Bob Iger, representing the Disney company, with Jimmy Pitaro and Connor Schell. On pops Adam Silver, representing the NBA, with David Denenberg and Dion Kokoris, Greg Winnick. And then on pops MJ. And we all just expressed our gratitude for having been able to do this. It took 20 years. It took a lot of consensus building. This wasn't easy. But here we are, and to be in a position to make people happy, to make Colin Cowherd happy,
yes,
have people thank us for bringing their families together, for giving them something to look forward to on the weekends. You know, for me as an old school guy, I love the fact people would clamor on Monday morning, "Oh, Mike, can't you send me the next 8 episodes?" No. I like the way it rolled out, 2 at a time, people talking about it in between. Yeah, things will change over 10 years, 20 years, but this feels really good right now, Colin, I got to say.
Yeah. You let it breathe, you let it bake. And for the record, in this awful pandemic, it has been great content with no games. The Mondays are our easiest show of the week because of this great documentary, The Last Dance. His name is Mike Tolan. He's done remarkable work. We always feel lucky when we get smart people who are curious and, you know, you are joining, by the way, Mike, Dr. Patrick Chong, the billionaire, owner of the LA Times, who is working on a vaccine for COVID. So it's,
wow.
We've got a heck of a Saturday podcast, Mike. Congratulations to you and Jason, and thank you so much for taking time for us.
Thanks. Always great talking to you, Colin. Appreciate it.